Hello and welcome to another edition of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com on DAB, and of course on our podcast, which you can find on Audioboom and Spotify. I'm AD Packham and we are with you with the brilliant assistance of OldFootballShirts.com. Well, a dramatic finale to the game at Stoke last Saturday ensured we came home with a point, but it was a game where if we'd have taken our earlier chances, we really should have come home with all three. We now just sit 2 points above the dreaded dotted line. Today, we forget all about that, though, as we all get another dose of cup fever. Feeling a bit peaky, Al. I'm feeling a bit peaky.
Easy, boy, easy.
A victory over Coventry in today's FA Cup six-round tie would see us into the sixth round for the first time since 1986. Coventry, of course, were cup winners in 1987, but things have not been so good for them since. Joining me to discuss this and more is, of course, Alan Wares, and we're delighted to welcome a Coventry fan in the shape of Rob Stevens. We'll also hear from a former Coventry and Albion player in the shape of Gary Howlett a little bit later on. But Rob, it's not you're not a raw virgin.
No, second time on the show.
Yeah, now, welcome back, mate.
You were here, I think it was when we were playing Coventry back in the Championship a few years ago, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. I'll tell you what it was. I invited Rob in because they had the stuff with the owners of the ground, and Rob can tell us in a minute, were really kicking off, and there was...
The Keep Cov and Cov campaign.
There was Keep Cov and Cov, and then there was, yeah, there was Keep Cov there, and then throw them here and put, and there seemed to be sort of, it was more like the PFJ and then the JFP and then the people splitters. And one day Coventry will be united. Rob, tell us which faction do you represent?
I represent one of the 10,000 factions that have come out of the five factions of their.
So
since,
that's the People's Republic of Judea.
Yes, right. But every sort of, well, I would say every is against Wasps, who now actually own the ground. London Wasps, you know, that classic Midlands rugby team, and yeah, it's not got any better.
For our listener who didn't hear you last time, give us if you can, the brief history over what the last 10 years since the owners of the Rico Arena. Took on their charge?
Well, Sisu, the current owners of the club, took over, but they never actually owned the ground. They always rented, because when Coventry moved away from Highfield Road, they couldn't afford to put any money into the new ground at the Rico. So the council and local charity stepped in and kind of split the odds of the cost, and Sisu never bothered to buy the charity's share for what was then £6 million, and a big kerfuffle blew up because they didn't think later on it was worth £6 million, and the upshot was a few years ago Wasp stepped in and decided they could buy it for a few £ million, which was of course less than £6 million, and the club were not allowed to bid or didn't have their bid accepted, and so Wasp's now on the ground and we rent it. We have just signed a deal to rent it for another year, which isn't that secure.
1 year at a time? You haven't got a long-term lease?
No.
So just to put this back into perspective then, so you sold Highfield Road and to move into this brand spanking new stadium, which you
who
didn't
paid for
actually
it? Who,
own.
Who paid for the stadium?
There was European money went in. There was all sorts. It was on an old gasworks and the Brownfield site, so... Tesco built a supermarket, which is the big sort of shopping centre right next to the ground, and I think they put in about £50 million for that, so that's where a lot of the money came from. There was 12-13 million shortfall, which the club couldn't afford to spend, couldn't afford to pay, which is where the council and a local charity linked to a former Coventry City director who had passed away, kind of stepped in and... put up the money.
Right. So it all sounds a little bit of a mess, frankly. And all various things done without forethought, without sort of a long-term plan.
It's kind of a throwback to those days when things may have been done on a bit of a handshake and not, but then should have been done with proper contracts. But then other people came in and, you know, there's all sorts of things we found out.
How the Goldstone got sold, yeah. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like a sort of continuation of that kind of attitude, but then it's a mess.
I can hear that you're totally exasperated with 10 years of absolute nonsense.
Oh, and beyond that, this is the thing. This goes back to when Geoffrey Robinson, the current who's MP for Coventry, took over the club from the Robbins family, who I guess...
Again, the similarities.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, the Robbins family sort of looked after the club and took it into the top flight, and you know, they felt they couldn't compete in the Premier League. So this is when Geoffrey Robinson's family took over and spent loads of money. We got Ron Atkinson in, who didn't even last a season, spent loads of money. Gordon Strachan took over, and they eventually almost went bankrupt, having sold Highfield Road and everything else, which is where Sisu stepped in with Ray Ranson, former Man City player. Mm-hmm. They'd been scrabbling around to try and buy clubs all over the country. I think they tried to look at Cardiff, Leeds. They were on the verge of buying Southampton.
Glad they didn't look at us.
Well, I think even they weren't thinking at the time Brighton were that good an investment, and they wanted to get a club into the Premier League and make loads of money by trading players and getting in the Premier League, and they didn't do that. Sisu, who basically ended up with his in their lap with the kind of underwriters for the money, Ray Ranson's kind of long gone. There's a director of the time, Gary Hoffman, long-term family Coventry City fan who's been trying to buy the club from the current owners who don't really want to know. They don't have to sell because now we're breaking even. We have no assets apart from our very old dilapidated training ground. So no big investors, none of the sort of Chinese consortia that seem to be buying every other Midlands club are that interested in us because there's nothing to back us up. Okay. So it's,
well, we will come back and talk to about this and let's see if there is a way out of it and any light at the end of the tunnel. But first, we do need to talk about last Saturday, which was a game at Stoke City. I was disappointed, Al.
Why were you disappointed, eh?
Because I, if you, the, well,
was it the food?
The food was fine, but if you look at the last minute penalty and the goal line clearance, it doesn't actually tell the whole story.
No,
and we had so many chances in this game to actually put it to bed and out of their sight, and it was just they all fell to the same player. And I was ultimately very frustrated about it.
Well, probably you and everyone else. So, but therein lies the story of our season. We've created chances. I mean, there's games where we haven't even looked like a sniff of scoring, but there's so many times we've created chances and the ball has ended up in the back of the stand. And you do actually then scratch your head and you think, how on earth are these people getting paid? It's not, I suppose that the correlation between how much they get paid and what their actual technical ability is isn't necessarily the case, but the whole notion of just being able to shoot, which, you know, we actually did manage to work out how to do against West Ham, and it worked. And you just think, just do the same again. So, yeah, the frustration is there for all to see, but you do wonder that when a player has the opportunity to score a goal, i.e. just kicking the ball into that 192 square feet of area that, you know...
Or heading,
or...
Kneeing, thighing...
Bum, off your backside or anything... as long as it goes in, that they're trying to go for. I mean, when Izquierdo scored that absolute world against West Ham, that's fabulous, and you love seeing goals, and you pay good money to see that, absolutely. But it doesn't follow that every goal that you score has to be like that. And sometimes just kick the ball accurate and hard towards the goal. Don't even try and, you know, when they take a shot and they're leaning back and the technique's all wrong and. You know, sorry, hashtag Solly March, whose shooting this season has been absolutely abysmal. I'm sure he's not the only person we're thinking of here, and I'm sure it's not the person you're thinking of. Right, okay, I'll finish my rant. You carry on with your rant. You tell us cheesed you off.
Well, we'll go back to the beginning. Solly March came in for Knockaert, and Jurgen Lacazette made his debut on the bench. It has been mentioned, Al, that this might have been our strongest ever bench.
I don't know who else was on the bench. I mean,
the bench was Tim Krul, Bruno, Baron Kyle, Anthony Knockaert, Leo Ojoa, Goldson, Lacardia.
Lacardia twice?
Yeah, two Lacardia.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's no mate weights on there. There's no one you think, well, I'm not sure they're going to be able to step up. I mean, everyone's pretty much got experience of being in there. But actually, the bench is by the way, it's the first 11 that's the important bit. It's nice to have a good, strong bench, absolutely. But it's the first 11 who start. And if they don't sort, you know, do the business by kicking the ball low and accurate and hard into the goal, then you're screwed before you start. So But okay, I've asked again. Let's ask again. What's frustrated you apart from the who is your bete noire then?
That, well, we're going to come to that.
Are you building up to it?
Yeah. Okay. Basically, a bad pass from Stoke allows Gross to find Murray, and he lays off to Esquerdo, who cuts inside and shoots, but his shot is well saved by England's number one elect, Jack Butland.
You reckon he's number one elect?
I think he will be the goalkeeper at the World Cup.
Go on, Rob. What do you reckon?
Well, we did manage to put one past him in the FA Cup.
Yeah.
So. Oh, no, we put two past him. One worldie.
Yeah.
And one dribbler.
Yeah, well, it's clearly not going to be Joe Hart that's going to be... Well, it probably will be. Therein lies the point. Is going to be the number one choice.
It's between Butland and Pickford, I believe.
Right. God. What happened to the days of Graham Moseley and Eric Steele or... But even Joe Corrigan and then Peter Shilton and Ray Clark, we're not blessed with goalkeepers these days, are we?
Well, we are, but...
Well, not English ones, sorry.
Well, and therein is the sad indictment. We've got three goalkeepers in our first team, not one of them is English, and...
Well, to be fair, one is out on loan.
Yeah, but he's not in the first team squad at the moment, is he? Because
yeah,
he's out on loan at Wigan.
Point, yeah.
But, I mean, the chances are he will come back and he will be in the squad next season.
One would think so.
But that doesn't necessarily guarantee he's going to get any game time. And it also depends on what division we're in. Now, with you, Rob, I'm in Coventry. I don't actually know who your goalkeeper is. What nationality is he?
I'd hardly say it's an advantage, but watching a team in League Two, you get to watch a lot of English players.
Yeah.
So Lee Burge will be in goal for us, probably, although it might be O'Brien, who is Irish. We've got a few Irish players, Scots, Frenchmen, and everything else.
Just English.
Everyone else is English. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a trick. I mean, the English leagues now are truly multinational. It's not just the Premier League that's got a vast array.
Yeah,
of
Yeah, but you'll
imports.
Find a greater number of English players playing in the lower divisions. I think is the point that's being made here. Now, whether that's a good or bad thing, yes, everyone's getting plenty of game time, but somewhere down the line, the quality isn't being raised enough that they can then sort of bust into the, you know, into the teams and be, you know, how many squads are there in the Premier League who are, you know, top heavy with English players? But getting back to your point, sorry, yes, well saved by Jack Butland. But, you know, should he have scored? Could he have? Well, I mean, so, of course, could he have scored?
It was a harder chance than the one he had at Southampton a week or so ago.
Yeah.
I mean, it did bring out the best out of the goalkeeper. I'm prepared to give the goalkeeper the
benefit of
the
doubt. Actually, we've got someone who's actually prepared to take the shot. Where previously, I mean, there's games where, you know, I was watching the Middlesbrough game. And we were diabolical, and there was almost this complete and utter reluctance, this almost refusal to attack until Esquerdo came on as substitute for Scalac. And he really vitalised everyone. He was actually doing things like running with the ball, taking a shot. All right, some of them, you know, might have ended up in red card, but they were, you know, he was actually bothering to do it. Whereas, you know, Middlesbrough, and let's face it, we owed them.
Well, this is the thing now, Al, because with Jose Esquerdo at the moment, I mean, when he first came, obviously there was a big price tag. He didn't go straight into the team. Chris has managed him quite well. He's mm-hmm. realised
he's having a stormy
time
at the moment.
Up, but now we're seeing the player that we've actually paid all that money for.
Absolutely,
and he's a joy to watch, and he's lighting the place up, and he scored that special goal against West Ham. But I think the goal he scored last Saturday was even more special.
Well, it's because it's more of a team effort, and we don't score team effort goals like that. I mean, you know, when you got because actually, it's interesting. It was criticism. I don't think it was criticism. It was fair as such. But when you said, I think it was either Gross or Prabhu who sent the ball out wide to Esquerdo, that was my first thought. I'm thinking, well, actually, the goal's over there, and you're going sort of over to the touchline. I don't think it was necessarily the case that they were going to do a couple of big 1-2s, but seeing as, you know, Esquerdo did go and hit the afterburners and go racing past the Stoke defence, which actually, I wouldn't say it was flat-footed, but they started just looking around saying, what on earth's happening here? And I'd say with the big 1-2s, I think Solly March was first, and was it Stevens?
Stevens
was second.
One, yeah.
And then jinked inside his man and stick it in the bottom corner.
The only reason,
I think it won't be a feature on Goal of the Month. Well, there's two reasons. One, because Esquerdo's already got a contender for Goal of the Month. And two, because Butland did get a hand to it, whereas Adrian for West Ham didn't.
I'm still saying it was a better goal for me.
It was a better team goal.
What, can you think of a better team goal? It's certainly the best
off
one
the
we scored this
hand.
Season.
Oh, yeah, well, by a distance. Off the top of my head, I think there was probably some really good ones that we scored under Gus Poyet in the last season with Dean. But you have to bear in mind it was the third division and we're talking about a different quality in terms of enjoying the games that you saw.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's put it to jury, Rob. What?
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, as the neutral in this conversation, what is your favourite type of goal?
I've got to say, I do like a good team goal, but at the same time, my favourite goal of the season for us this season is from our very low scoring striker Max Biamu, and he basically headed it on. One of our players touched it and ran out of the way because he came steaming in from 25 yards and buried it in the back of the net.
And we're talking Yeboah style.
The 25, 30-yard screamer.
In off
you
the
know,
crossbar?
Nope, just net. The classic net bulger, top corner. Doesn't even hit the stanchion, but
right.
You know, the
staunchion,
onion bag
isn't it? Isn't it staunchion?
Staunchion?
Jimmy Hill's staunchion, yeah.
So basically connection. What you're saying is the sort of goal that makes you make an involuntary noise.
Maybe because I've just been so behind Max Biamu to actually score this season, and that was his first league goal of the season. And everybody stood there was like, I was there when Max Biamu scored.
So you like the Thunderbird?
The Thunderbolt.
Thunderbolt, yeah.
Yes.
But then 40 passes, you know, and walked into the back of the net, you know. I'll take any goal at the moment. Our goal scoring is that
your
bad.
Your favourite type of goal? If you had to pick one.
Well,
gun to your head.
Well, actually, I mean, I think actually I've got two types, and Izquierdo scored the both of them in the last couple of weeks. So, and that's not sort of me dodging
the
question.
Is there a third one that you want to challenge him to try next week? Maybe.
I tell you what we haven't seen.
Home goal in the FA Cup's quite good for Cov fans, actually. But you know.
Oh, we're good at them as well. I tell you what we haven't seen from a Brighton player for years and years and years, and I'm sure they're probably outlawed and quite dangerous, is that we haven't seen the flying overhead scissor kick. Could do with one of them.
Dale Stevens, QPR a couple
of
years ago.
No, a flying overhead. He just kind of leant backwards and fell backwards. Yeah, that wasn't
Craig McHale Smith at Burnley.
Yeah, not so bad. I'm thinking more Trevor Sinclair for QPR.
I was worrying it was going to be a regular occurrence at Brighton.
No, it's not.
If any of the current squad are actually listening, there's your challenge. Okay, but I mean, just describe the goal again. I mean, so Gross squares to Izquierdo midway right inside the Stoke half. The South American Express cuts inside and plays a 1-2 with Solly March and then another with Dale Stevens before firing past Butland.
It was a beauty, and I did enjoy Warren Aspinall's comment. Was that Brighton or Barcelona I was watching?
Well, I mean, for me, I mean, it was the speed, the zip in which it was played, and it's what we saw Liverpool do against us, and what we've seen Chelsea do against us. It's just nice for us to actually up the tempo, and the metronome for this is Jose Izquierdo.
Yes, I mean, the point is that he is. It shows that we can do it. Whether you know four or five passes ahead, which is what you see Liverpool doing, it's what you see Chelsea doing, it's what we don't see us doing, because someone like Dale Stevens or David Pereira will sit on the ball and say, well, there's no pass on, let's go backwards, let's slow everything down, let's stop. Whereas, you know, when Chelsea, Liverpool, City, whatever it is, go forward, bang, 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 they know, you know, if they're on song. But the show is that we can do it, so therefore if we can, then let's do it.
But there was
and if there's any commentary fans listening to this before the game, we mean today.
Okay, some neat interplay leads to Gross, just for a change, crossing for Pereira, but he could not control his header. It seems to be over. You see, I mean,
Pereira hasn't scored for us yet.
No,
he
hasn't, and he had four very, very good chances.
Is he the fella you got frustrated
with? Yes, it is.
Tell us
because
about your frustration.
I actually
then.
Thought he was actually. He was man of the match apart from the missus. But
your missus Blade.
Yeah.
what was she doing out there?
It's big squad. Big squad you've got this season.
It's big squad. I mean, it's very, very diverse.
Yeah, he was brilliant. He was everywhere, box to box, breaking things up, and he was actually playing further forward and actually getting himself into those positions to have those
finally
chances, which
and
was
you're
great.
Still frustrated.
But I think he just needs one. If he gets one, then he can go on and get 6, 7, 8 for the rest of the season.
So what you're saying here is, are you fed up with it, or are you?
No, I was just annoyed because, I mean, the way that the game panned out and these chances, I mean, that would have that chance would have put us 2-0 up. We could have, there was other chances where we could have gone, taken, extended our lead and then extended it again. And these chances kept them falling. And then we gave too much time and space to someone who needs a lot of space in Shaqiri.
I thought it's interesting. You said he's enormous. I mean, he's kind of barrel shaped. I mean, it's like someone has taken a 6'2" hunk and actually whacked him with an oversized mallet into the ground,
like a whack a mole.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, he's the size of a double wide bungalow in the Cotswolds, basically. But he's quite wide.
Stone built, or are we talking, you know, with a hearth and a fire and a nice garden? Or,
well, I think he's going to get a thatch soon. Maybe,
yeah, but, probably will. Actually, it was a decent, that, I mean, as much as, yeah, we backed off him and let him shoot, it was actually a very good finish. And yes, you're quite right, you can't actually afford to allow
that. Yeah, well, the ball fell for Shaqiri on the edge of the box, who has time and space to find a spot and curl it in, and you can't give a player like that.
We
saw it at the Amex as well.
Absolutely.
You can't give him the time and space to do that. And Gaetan Bong was there, and he backed off, and he should have gone, began to the ball. But
so wise, who used to be wise after the event? But yes. So yeah, and then we've got the carnage of the penalty. Now then, we're back to the phrase. One of the phrases, and there are lots of them, I detest so much. What on earth is a soft penalty? It's either a penalty or it's not a penalty.
It's not a penalty, Al.
No, but people saying it was a soft penalty. There is no such thing. So yes, you're quite right. I fully agree with you. It shouldn't have been a penalty. It was ridiculous.
The big Hesse should not have gone down like that.
Yeah, I know, and I did read your blog, and yeah, it reads better than it sounds, but. No, it was pathetic. It wasn't a foul in the first place. It was almost the two of them. You know, like a couple of kittens sort of going, me, 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 me. If you can actually look at me on the radio, I'm going, me, 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 like two kittens do. That's what they were doing, and one decided to fall over. That's not a foul. That's called cheating. And the referee, like an idiot, fell for it.
But the thing is, this is what gets me. I mean, maybe the club have seen it differently to my eyes and everyone else's eyes that have seen it. But it was never a pen, right? And we've seen...
Should never have been a pen. It clearly was.
We've seen retrospective action against Nias for calling the officials to get a penalty.
And he
subsequently got a ban.
Yeah.
But no one is mentioning this incident at all in the same sort of way. Now, I've got... Does that... Because we haven't
because we're Brighton. We're not Man United. We're not Everton. We know what, you know, it's not one of the big clubs. I suppose Nias's thing was against Palace, so, you know, of course it's the smallest club in the division, but, you know, it's...
the world.
No, the nature of the inconsistency is maddening, and you get to realise that there are various aspects of the Premier League, although it's supposed to be a wonderful thing, there's various aspects of it that are just a total con. So with this, yeah, it was... It was just two people trying to let go of each other's hands, and one decides to fall over. I mean, it's absolutely pathetic.
The question you have to ask in regards to this, would that have been given as a foul anywhere else on the pitch?
Actually, that case, no. In that instance, no, because nothing happened. Someone decided to put themselves on the floor. He didn't even dive. He just fell to the floor.
It was like one of those donkeys where you press the button and it collapses.
That sort of thing. I mean, I don't know about you, Rob, but, you know, the nature of the consistency of referees when it comes to what is
come,
a penalty.
Come back down to League Two when you want to talk about consistency of referees.
Go on, do tell.
Oh, I mean...
without swearing.
I actually feel sympathetic to referees because we do need better, higher quality, more referees from all over to actually come in and make sure matches at all levels of the game are actually properly officiated. Yeah. I really don't like it when managers especially lead the charge about how terrible referees are and pick people off. But there are times when, especially in League Two, where it's just like you genuinely don't know what you're doing. But I wouldn't want to pick on referees. I mean, I think assistants can be annoying as well.
Yeah.
I mean, I personally would like to see a lot of... I would like to see players going, as soon as they can't play anymore, going to refereeing because they've played the game, they know how it works, and then they know someone's trying to con
wages,
them.
It's not even just the wages thing. It's known full well that you're going to be... Well, you think, I loved football. I had a wonderful time playing it. And then you're a referee and you actually become villain number one.
Works in cricket.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You have this honesty and this dignity of players, you know, of an ex-county player, umpiring your own team. Mm. I mean, if you've got, for instance, let's have an ex Coventry and Brighton player. Let's say Chris Catlin.
Adam Virgo.
I don't know if Chris could actually referee at the moment.
Well, you know what I mean, but you know, instead of opening up a rock shop, he'd gone into refereeing. You know, does that mean he had to avoid all the Brighton games, all the Coventry games, and therein does he have to avoid the Palace games and whoever Coventry's main sort of bet noirs are, you know, main enemies are, and there's the consideration that you know,
I hate them that much.
Who, sorry?
I'm not going to mention them. I hate them that much.
Oh, okay.
Plus, they're way more successful than us.
Oh, right. Okay. But yeah, there's the consideration of he's going to be biased because he played for them, and then you don't have that sense of level of trust. So I get the point. But yes, you'd like to think. But having said that, when it comes to listening to punditry, all right, this is a punditry show. But you know, you listen to punditry on Match of the Day, you get to realise that they don't know how to referee either. So you know, where do you go from there?
But I mean, you've got the respect campaign now. Would as a player, would you respect someone who's played, I don't know, 300 games for Coventry City against someone who works in a fish and chip shop the rest of the week?
Well, a lot of it comes down to actually knowing the rules of the game. And like, I think the last Saturday game I missed, and I think it might have been one of our first or second round FA Cup games, I watched the BT Sport game. They have a referee on regularly, sort of giving the backup of like why the decision was made and this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and that's really good.
But the players, one in particular, a serial cheat when he was a player and still a serial cheat when he's on the actual telly, and I won't mention his name because he used to play for our hated rivals, that he cheated to get on the radio and the TV, I'm sure, but he refused to listen to the referee's opinion and he turned it into, why it should be like this. And you hear that Alan Shearer is another good one for this. It's like, oh, well, that might be the rule, but it should be like this, therefore. And it's like, respect what is, if you don't like the rules of the game, that's fine, you can change them, but just respect the guy who's trying to lay down the law as it stands.
Absolutely.
At the moment.
Yeah.
And I think another problem is as well, you know, there's going to have to be a time when, and it's happening a little bit more now, but players need to just shut up and accept decisions. And I don't think that's ever going to happen. But swearing in a referee's face and all this kind of stuff, just...
Yeah, pack it in, yeah.
Okay. Well, there was a big hoo-ha about who was going to take the penalty.
That's
and Hesse,
well,
and Hesse
yeah.
was most upset that his... collapse.
How unprofessional is that? I mean, it's ridiculous. If you're a Stoke City fan, irrespective of what Charlie Adam did in the end, if you're a Stoke City, if I was a Brighton fan and you argued the toss over whether it was Hemed or Murray,
they have had an argument about it before.
But they've got to realise they didn't have their pecking order sorted out. And the point is they have now. It's Hemed is the first penalty taker at the club. Murray is the second one. They should have done it there. And, you know, if Hesse knew that Charlie Adam is the main penalty taker at Stoke City, he had no right to moan. And his captain would have said, right, you sunshine there.
Well, he did.
Well, quiet.
And
Lambert was embarrassed about it as well.
But enter Private Ryan. And it was a terrific save, but arguably, I mean, as much
don't
as we're,
care, don't
we're
care.
Saying
he
that,
knocked it out for a corner, I don't care. Was it a penalty? Don't care.
That was more of a penalty than the one that was actually given.
Oh, God, yes, yeah. I mean, but I didn't actually look at it too closely, just in case it really should have been a penalty.
But, I mean, Stoke, who throughout the game were worse at corners than we are, which is saying something,
yeah.
They had a couple of corners straight after that in injury time, and it took a miraculous goal line clearance from Anthony Knockhart to retain parity.
Absolutely. Well, it wasn't miraculous. It hit. You know, it went towards him, but thankfully Knockhart was there at the right time, the right place. So
someone actually on the line from a corner.
Absolutely,
amazing.
Yeah.
And it was nice to see the old Hawkeye thing in action as well.
How far off the line was it?
It was three quarters of the ball was over the line.
All right, okay. Well, good. That's not a goal.
A few of your Premier League extra cameras.
I know. It does feel weird, actually. I mean, like, I do appreciate the complete and utter role reverse that we've had here when Coventry were 30 years in the top division and...
37.
Yeah.
But okay, but you are listening
to... Don't get ahead of yourselves.
The Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are delighted that the show is sponsored by the magnificent oldfootballshirts.com. And as you know, every week Phil gives us a shirt of the week. And it's a bit of a special one. I'm just going to hand this over to...
It's a shirt of the week that actually he's randomly chosen off his website of 84,000 shirts. shirts. And 84,000
shirts.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to this doozy.
I know it already from the back.
There you go. Can you just describe this? I think I don't think you need to guess who it is.
It's a replica. It's a reissue. Oh, yeah, I know a few people who've actually got this one.
Go on, then. Do
so it's not actually. So basically, this isn't actually a real one.
Describe what you're looking at.
I am looking at blue and white vertical stripes. It is the Coventry City 1987 FA Cup shirt. Looking at the way the sponsor's logo is applied, this is really sad.
Go on.
Considering the shirt I'm actually wearing now, it doesn't look like the original one from 87.
Right.
As somebody who's watched the 87 Cup final both in person and many, many times since, it looks slightly different. And we did do a reissue. The club did a reissue, possibly of this one. When was it? Not on the anniversary, which was...
It might be your printer, Aidy, but...
It probably is.
I was about to say, it looks very, very dark, and I can't recall that Coventry had sort of much paler blue...
I think that's the printer.
I mean compared to the Hummel doozy you're wearing now...
We'll describe the Hummel doozy in a minute, actually, and we'll take a picture of that and put that up on the website as well. Yeah. But tell us what Phil's chosen
for us. Well, here you go, then. A bit of relevance to this week's shirt, as it's a blue and white striped shirt as well. And this is the 1987 shirt worn by the FA Cup winners, Coventry City. The unfancy side took on Spurs in the Wembley showdown and dumped them on their arses 3-2 after extra time. The Coventry fanzine, GMK, an acronym of Gary Mabbott's knee, refers to the own goal he scored in extra time to get the Sky Blues victory and the trophy. The final was commentated on by John Motson, who commented after that it was the finest FA Cup final he's ever had the pleasure of commentating on. It was a clean, good-willed, yet well-contested final with no bookings and high-quality football being produced by both sides. That will never happen again, says Phil.
Probably not.
Spurs decided to play in their new kit for the next season in that game, but a mix-up meant that only half the team had the Holston sponsors on their shirts and the rest had plain shirts. I remember
that. I never knew that.
I did, yeah. Yep. And Gary Stevens, who played in that game as well as in the FA Cup final, he had one of the plain ones, I believe.
Oh, okay.
But a match fact, Steve Grizovic remained with Coventry until retiring as a player in the year 2000, and he was Coventry's last remaining player from the final when he played his last game for him. Gary Mabbott, who stayed at Spurs until 1988, was the last player to play for Spurs from that final. So there you go. Thanks for Phil. Of course, you can check that shirt out on
our current gaffer in that side.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
And he was at fault for one of the goals, I believe.
He's lurking in the background of Steve Houchin's greatest goal ever scored at Wembley.
Keith Houchin.
Mm. Keith Houchin, who did I say, sorry?
Steve Houchin. Steve Who's that?
No, never heard of him. Okay. Sorry, Steve Houchin. Yeah, okay, that shows what a great fan I am.
If you remembered it, you weren't there.
But oldfootballshirts.com, of course, like as we said, there's thousands of shirts. You can go on there, knock yourself out, check them all out. They're amazing. And if you like, and there's a load of ads on there where you can click on stuff if you like it. So have a look at that. And that's oldfootballshirts.com. Okay, notice board then. Coming up very shortly is the annual Reverbathon, Al. It's on the
Saturday, March the 3rd. Radio Reverb. It is run by volunteers. None of us get paid here. We do exist on grants, sponsorship and donations.
Hot
air. And we are asking you for, if you want to help keep Radio Reverb alive and kicking on the air, if you could just donate a few quid, or rather a lot of quids, to us. And we'll give you more details as the time approaches.
And if you'd like to be one of the sponsors of our show next on, please contact us at thealbionraw@yahoo.co.uk.
Please do.
And because we, as well as Phil Shelley's oldfootballshirts.com, we will be having a few other sponsors
Absolutely.
For the day. It's going to be a good one. Hopefully, we'll have some
decent
guests.
In that case, I'm going to do a quick shout out to Jerry Hussain of the Best of Brighton, who's already agreed to sponsor us. So that's fabulous. Thank you, Jerry.
Okay, and it's Remp season quickly.
Okay, Thursday, March 29th at the Heineken Lounge. It's the annual Remp quiz where everyone falls out. I think that everyone's going to be there, going to test your knowledge. knowledge, snog your beer and eat pies, and the winner will be getting the prestigious Renf Quiz trophy. I'm hoping the chap to my right will be representing Coventry City and come along to that evening, and that'll be fabulous. Okay, well, he's more than welcome.
Well, if we win today, then
another person who has represented Coventry City is, of course, Albion, the former Albion midfielder, Gary Howlett, and I caught up with him earlier on today. Okay, I'm now joined by a former Albion midfielder and Coventry midfielder, Gary Howlett, who joined us on the line from Ireland. How are you, Gary?
Good evening, Eddie. All good, Albert. Yeah, all good, Eddie. Nice to talk to you.
So it's we've got Coventry City in the FA Cup this weekend. Obviously, you've got a history with both, but how is it you ended up in Coventry?
Well, we're going back a long time now, Eddie. We're going back to pre-1980.
Yeah.
When I would have been playing for the local schoolboy team, which would have been Home Farm. So Home Farm are a good, obviously, big schoolboy club over here. And there would have been a lot of scouts going to games. And the Coventry Scouts was a bit of a legend at the time, a gentleman called Bunny Fulham. And Bunny always had a keen interest in me going through the years as I was a young teenager, going up right up to 17.
Yeah.
So I stayed on. My parents wanted me to stay on and finish my education up till 17. I'd done my leaving cert. And then it was really a choice. I had a few choices, but I went on trial to Coventry after my leaving cert in the summer of 1980, and I went to Liverpool. But I just fell in love with Coventry at the time, the setup they had then in them days, you know. So that's how I ended up there in 1980.
But you didn't. Did you actually play any games for them? I think you were just in the youth setup there, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. I signed professional forms. I didn't do any apprenticeship because I turned 17. But the manager at the time was Gordon Milne. So when I went in, I signed in the 10th of the 10th, 1980. And for the first 5 or 6 months, everything was going well. I was still, you know, progressing nicely, playing a bit of youth and a bit of reserve, and then playing, there would have been a couple of matches for Ireland still at that time. So then months flew in. And then unfortunately, around May 1981, my father passed away. So that had a bit of an impact on me. I came home, went back the following season, but I never really got going at all that second season at Coventry. But lucky enough, towards the end of that season, Coventry were playing in an end-of-season tournament in Holland. And there was a good few of us getting released from Coventry, and there were scouts there, and one of the scouts happened to be from Brighton, and that's where it was
Jimmy Amelia, wasn't it?
Jimmy Amelia, I think, was in it. Exactly, yeah. Jimmy was the youth, I think he was youth development officer or something like that.
Yeah, he was chief scout.
At Brighton.
So he was chief scout at the time.
He was chief scout at the time. Yeah, so we didn't know it when we were playing in that tournament that we were getting released. It was probably, you know, it wasn't until we came home from that tournament that we were, there was about 11 of us marched into the offices in Coventry and told one by one that we were going to be let go, you know. So, but I went home at the time, but there was a phone call quickly made. I had a phone call from Brighton and a phone call from Blackburn. Bobby Saxton was the manager at Blackburn at the time. And I told Bobby that I was going to go down to Brighton first. And I went down in the summer, that summer of 82. And, you know, determined to make amends and get my career back on track, you know. And it kind of, from day one, I felt comfortable at Brighton. And I got quickly offered a contract then in 1982, in the summer of 82.
I mean, the social climate in Coventry in the early 80s can't have been much fun, as the Specials are famously documented a few times in some of their songs, like Ghost Town, for instance. So coming to Brighton must have been a breath of fresh air.
Well, I can't say that about Coventry. I had a fantastic time at Coventry. It was a different city altogether, obviously, you know, them days. But it was still thriving a little bit with the car industry. But it was failing off there towards the early 80s. Okay, but you know, it was a great education for me there. You know, in Coventry, and I had great digs. An Irish couple, and who have since become friends with their son, who actually works with me. It's a bit of a story there. But it was completely different coming down to Brighton. Like straight away, the climate, it was warmer. It was sunnier.
Not so smoggy.
And it was, pardon?
Not so smoggy.
Not so No, you're giving. I tell you, I have to. You have to go on a little trip up the country. It's not as bad.
Oh,
as
I've
that.
Been.
It really isn't. But Brighton was different. It was lovely to see side, and it was lovely in Hove. I eventually got a place in Hove.
No, you were down by the King Alfred, I understand.
Yeah, you've done your research there. Fair play to you, Heidi. Yeah, St. Catherine's Terrace, straight across the road from the old swimming pool there. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Oh, it's still there.
Who's
it's
been feeding you this information?
it's still there, that swimming pool. But you came to Brighton, and you were a young 19-year-old, and you're playing a few reserve team games, and you got yourself into the first team squad, and you're on the bench a couple of times in that March, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, like I came down, and like it was, you know, again in them days the squads were huge, like, you know, and you were looking at internationals there and, you know, all sorts. But I felt comfortable, and I was determined to give it a go, get myself fit, and, you know, be ready if I did get a chance. You know, so I was playing regular in up to Christmas in the reserves, and Jimmy was great. He was there in the background encouraging all the young lads, you know, to keep going. And then I nearly got in the squad under Mike Bailey. And of course, Mike Bailey got sacked then, I think, around Christmas time or just after. And then Jimmy got the job. So Jimmy gives it, you know, I was wondering who was going to get a chance to as the young lads. So eventually I made my debut in March. And it was a midweek game, and it was against Liverpool. A great Liverpool side, and
22nd of March 1983, if you want the exact day.
22nd of March, there you are now. I knew it was March. I wasn't sure. It was just before my birthday, so it was a nice birthday present. And Jimmy said it was always, he'd always get me a special game, so it was a special game. And so then, of course, in the end days, like we weren't winning a lot of matches, so I was in and out of the side from then.
Well, let's just rewind to that game against Liverpool, because I mean it was a special game for another reason, because you marked your debut with a goal.
That's right, yeah. I actually scored, I'd say it was the only goal I ever scored with my head, but it was I remember a ball got played out left in the dugout side, and I kind of made a run into the box, which I wasn't famous for, but I managed to get on the end of a cross and head it in, and we were 2-0 up actually, I think, in that game.
Yeah, and apparently the fans were chanting famously, "What's to Bruce Grobbelaar? What's the score?" And he responded, as he would. And then Ian Rush got two goals to get parity.
That's right.
I remember it. I remember. It. I was.
I just ran out of steam. We just ran out of steam in the second half. They kind of came back at us, you know. But you know, there was. Following them games then, I was in and out of the side, you know, and there was big games. We weren't doing well in the league. But I got back in the side then for the Cup semi-final, of course, against Sheffield Wednesday in Highbury.
Yeah.
And that was a fantastic occasion.
Yeah, that was due to an injury to Jerry Ryan, I believe.
Yeah, Jerry. You see, I have to say, you know, you either had good luck or bad luck when you're playing, you know, and you can make your own luck. But I did, everything went for me in them few months. Unfortunately, it has to come at the expense of injuries to other players and stuff like that, you know. But, and Jerry was a great player for Brighton in them days, and he was flying down the wing. But he did pick up an injury prior to that, and I got back in the side in that game. And it was a beautiful Saturday afternoon, sunny day in Highbury. And it was a great win, of course. One of Jimmy Case's specials helped.
Yeah, but I mean, Jimmy there, you know? Jimmy scored an absolute cracker in that game. But you had an effort from the halfway line.
That's right. Yeah. Well, not many people know that, Eddie, because in them days, obviously, there was highlights. It was just highlights, and I think ITV, and it would have been regional ITV, covered it. And the folks back in Ireland didn't see that attempt, actually, you know. So I was a bit peeved about that. But I didn't mind, as long as we won 2-1. It would have been nice if I had gone in, but I didn't mind. We got through. And it was. And then, of course, in them days, the semi-finals were on the same time. And we were in the dressing room, and, of course, Manchester United beaten up in Villa Park. Did they beat Arsenal, I think, in the semi-finals?
Yes,
we knew
they did,
straight
yes.
away we were playing. We knew straight away we were playing United in the cup final, which was fantastic as well, you know.
So when did you find out that you were going to be in the cup final team?
I found out, and we played Norwich the previous week. I think Norwich was our final league game of the season. And I was worried and dependent. Was this going to be the game to decide, was I going to be playing in the cup final team? And Jimmy had a calm word with me, and he said, "Gary, relax." He said, "You'll be in the side." You know, so we got beaten against Norwich, I think 2-0, I think. Didn't play particularly well. But that week then, as the build-up, I knew that I was starting during that week. So it was a nice touch by Jimmy, and it was grateful to him for telling me that day, you know, because it was a worry whether you were going to be starting or not, you know.
Now, obviously, with in those days, the build-up to the FA Cup final was a massive thing, and there was the whole going to get your suits measured. Now, the suits that we had that year, I mean, we had Gordon Smith on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was telling us how horrible they actually were. I mean, did you manage to keep yours? I mean, Gordon said that it was a nice, nasty kind of beige.
It was a nasty kind of beige, and the shoes to match as well. I think you see, Jimmy Mealy was great in them days, but he had a big input, I think, into the design of the outfits. But I don't have mine personally, but I gave it to a brother of mine who he tells me he still has it somewhere in his wardrobe.
That's got to be worth a few quid, right?
To get it out. If ever I need to get it out, I'll. It could be worth a few bob now. Actually, could be.
I mean, it'd be nice. If the jacket and the trousers matched, though, right?
Yeah, it would have helped. It would have helped, but I don't think they did. No, yeah.
Tell us about your part in the FA Cup final single.
It was minimal. I was kept to the back. I was just kept to the back. The stars, the lads in them days, me and Kieran were kind of the babies of the team, so yeah. They looked after us well, and we were well looked after by the likes of Fozzy and Jimmy Case and all the senior players, you know. So they took all the heat that week leading into the cup final. You know, I had to do a few little things maybe for the Irish press, but they looked after us well in the build up, yeah. You know.
Okay, so the day itself, then the helicopter comes and picks you up and takes you to the ground. I mean, it was. I don't think a team's done it since, have they?
I don't think so, no. But I tell you, it was fantastic experience. Like it was because we were actually flying over, and you could see the busloads, you could see the Brighton fans, and making their way to the ground. And you know, it was a special idea. Whoever came up with it, you know, it was great. And of course, we were there in no time as well. Like of course, you know, but it was a great memory. And again, the cameras were on, and Fozzy and Jimmy were doing the interviews and all the story, you know. So it was a great build up. And then getting to Wembley itself, then and seeing the ground and the dressing rooms and having a walk out on the pitch and looking out for your family and trying to see them before the kick off and all that, you know, it was a great build up, you know.
Yeah, and of course, 12 minutes into the game, you had a massive input into it.
Yeah, well, it was a pass that's made many times in games all over, you know, but it was just floated in, and of course, it was a good ball in, but it was a great finish. It was a great finish, you know. Yeah.
It's often forgotten that Smith did actually score.
Well, this is it. Poor El Gordon. Like you say, it gets well. If anyone could have handled the miss, let me say that. Like, if anyone could have handled the scoring and then being remembered for the miss, it was Smith. You know, he was a great character, and he handled it really well. Yeah. And over his career, and he you know, he's done really well since then. Of course, after that, you know.
Well, he said to us on the show a couple of weeks ago that he said if he'd known he was going to miss that one at the end, he would have celebrated that goal a lot more.
Well, you see, we quickly, I suppose he told you as well, that we quickly forgave him in the bath when we realised that we were going to be on the same appearance money for the replay as we were for the first game. So it was we forgave him quickly enough, you know.
Okay, well, I mean, your career at Brighton carried on for the next season as well. But, I mean, it didn't really pan out too well for you. And you ended up being sold by Chris Catlin to Bournemouth. But, I mean, your manager there went on to be all right, didn't he?
Yeah, like again, like I think the following season, you know, you think something like that is going to happen every year. You know, I probably got carried away a little bit, didn't work as hard, of course, on my game. Chris Catlin came in, and Chris was a hard-working manager, you know, and he knew what he wanted. He wanted players to work hard, and there was players there, and he wanted to stamp his own mark on the team, and you know, he signed very good players, and I didn't perform enough for him, you know, to pick me, you know. So, but lucky enough, Harry Redknapp, Ron Greenwood used to come to a lot of our games, and Harry had asked Ron about me, and he recommended that I could be where to go, you know. And I went down to Bournemouth, and again, I had a good initial time, a good beginning, and we did very well. I did very well with them for the first part, and then at the start of the season that they got promoted, I got a bad medial ligament, my knee injury, and never really recovered again from that, you know. So career kind of disrupted a lot then after that, you know. So I came back to Ireland then after about 10 years in England, you know. But injuries and not working hard really, Eddie, was the story of my career after that, you know.
But there's one story, I mean, that does spring out, which is you're in a book called 555 Football Facts to Wow Your Mates, apparently. And it was all about your one and only cap. What can you remember about that?
Well, the most obvious part is that I had to travel a long, long way to get it. You know, it was one of them end-of-season tours that possibly... It started off in Dublin with a game against Poland, and then some of the initial squad couldn't make it across to Japan, you know, and so there was a few younger lads allowed to get in it, you know. But it was a fantastic experience, and at the time you don't think it's just going to end up with one cap, but unfortunately I didn't maintain the form in the coming years after that, and I ended up with the one, and it's a bit of a one cap wonders, you know. There's a few going
you
around
played 19 minutes you played
19 minutes. Well, I enjoyed them, and I think I played again for Ireland, but it was against a league side in that tournament. So, of course, it didn't count because you had to play against a country, you know. It was unfortunate. But 19 minutes, you have your facts. I tell you, I'll give you 10 out of 10 for all your facts here.
Okay, well, let's fast forward to now then. And your two old clubs face each other in the FA Cup this weekend. Now both at different ends of the footballing spectrum. What have you made firstly of how Brighton have done this season, and secondly about Coventry?
Well, you know, in similar type of ways, you know, they both had a fantastic memory in the 80s of cup finals. Of, you know, Coventry in the 1987,
yeah,
winning beat Sport, you know, and Brighton, and then. Again, you know, for a club like Coventry, who had spent 30 odd years in the top flight, and then to get relegated, and to see them, you know, drifting down, and again the horrible part of it, losing their ground, you know, and then fans, you know, boycotting the Rico, you know, they're in a tough position, Coventry, you know, and there was a little bit of similarity there in Brighton in the, you know, 10, 15 years ago, you know, so, but. If they can take an example from what Brighton are doing now, you know, they can learn a lot from it. Like, you know, how a club can nearly on its knees, you know, nearly gone into the conference and come back to be playing in the top league.
It's we would have gone into oblivion, I think, Gary, if we had lost that game at Hereford that day.
Oh, yeah, when you think about it, like, you know, I think it's... And then, but to think where you've come from there through fans and people willing to put their hands in their pocket, you know, the it's fantastic, and what they're doing this year, and, you know, the 28 points I think they have now, you know, but it's a dogfight there. There's about 10 or 11 teams, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, need a couple of wins, get up to the mid-30s might be enough, you know. And please God they do, because there's no doubt Chris Cooten, you know, he's done a fantastic job there, you know, and to get up the way they did after suffering the heartbreak the year before with the, you know, losing out on goal difference, you know, and to come back then the following year and make it extraordinary characters, you know, so far, you know, huge credit is due to everyone involved.
Okay, so, and finally, what are you up to now, Gary?
Well, a day job is with Aer Lingus. I came back in 1991 and I got working with Aer Lingus in 1992. Kept involved in football. Obviously, when I came back, I played for Shelbourne, who would have been the League of Ireland, you know, so we would have been competing against the clubs like where Richie Towell came from, you know, the Dundalks and all that, you know. So the great couple of years with Shelbourne in 1992, 1993, we won the league. Drifted, a few injuries again, got me badges. So I've been involved in management now in the last 10 years, not at the League of Ireland level. So there's the League of Ireland over here. So down below the League of Ireland is a league, and I'm involved at that level. And it suits me because I can combine my work with managing this team. They're called Colestor. So I love that. I've got four young kids ranging from 4 to 18, so they keep me busy as well, you know. So I'm enjoying life. It's good.
Well, Gary, you're going to have to use your job with Aer Lingus to get a ticket over to Gatwick and come and see us down in Brighton.
I will, lady. I have your number now. So, and of course, we have our mutual friend Liam, who's a mad Brighton supporter and Shelbourne supporter.
Well, so you can always hitch a ride with him. He's always here. He sits in front of me at the ground, poor sod.
Brilliant. Please, God. I'll hold you to that,
lady. Good stuff. Anyway, thank you. That was Gary Howlett speaking to us from Ireland, and we will speak to you soon. Thanks a lot, Gary.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was
lady.
Good Thanks to hear from much. Him there. That was great stuff. Really, really good stuff. I enjoyed that, actually. And he still sounds like an 18-year-old, to be honest. I mean, it's either you're recording, mate, boy. He just sounds like a big kid.
He doesn't look any different, actually.
And, okay, you've got pictures of him, have you?
Yeah, so he's a good... But, I mean, it's...
great memories of him being here, absolutely. I mean, it was... you know, he was the one who crossed the ball for Gordon Smith. He's got an assist in a cup final, so, you know, good for him. Listen, we've only got a few minutes left, so let's have a quick natter again with Rob from, you know, our resident Coventry fan, the one who lives in Brighton here.
Just the one. There are a few of us, actually.
I know. Listen, and of all things, actually, I was having a natter with my dad earlier today, and this is something I genuinely never knew, and we had to look it up because he said, I remember, but I can't remember his name. There is a Coventry hero that he went to school here at Fawcett, which is not Patron Fawcett, but is what is now known as York Place Annex. I mean, yeah, there's a fellow called Bill Glazier. Tell us about his time at Coventry City.
Well, I mean... Before my time, but he is probably considered by a lot of guys from the Coventry City London supporters I travel around with, friends of mine like Robin and Ian, who saw him play possibly our greatest player, places to play and greatest keeper. I mean, everyone knows about Steve Grizovic, but Bill was signed from that team you know up the road. And
The burning smell.
Took us from League, I'll say League 2, what was then the fourth division. A bit of a break when he broke his arm, literally, but took us into the top flight, into Europe, and all-round hero with the Brighton connection.
Okay, but the thing my dad remembers about him when he was a schoolmate is that he never played football all the while he was at school. He only started playing football when he was in the 14th Brighton Boys Brigade, of all things.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was a while ago, but I mean, things are slightly different for Coventry now in League 2, but as we're listening to Gary Howlett there, you pointed out you've been in the Wembley final more recently than us. the fact you beat our under-23s on the way there is neither here nor there.
Not
but
quite.
But I mean, there was 28,000 in the Rico last week.
Did you have a nice time?
We got beaten 2-0 at home by Accrington Stanley.
Who are
Ouch.
They?
Yeah,
exactly. All Coventry City. Who are they these days?
Yeah. So I mean, you know, we touched on it at the beginning of the show. Where is Coventry apart from to Brighton this weekend? But where is Coventry? Is everyone facing the right direction with a view to, you know, taking the club forward, or are you still sort of, you know, is it still a little bit of a mess?
It's a mess. I mean, people ask me this all the time, especially around Brighton, because you know Brighton have been there, done it, bought the T-shirt, had the T-shirt sold, and it. I like to think, having seen it happen in Brighton, and you know, before I even moved to Brighton, you know, I was back in them when they were sort of getting booted out of the Goldstone ground. So it's nice to be in a place where people appreciate that sort of utter fall and rise again. So there is hope, but at the moment we have owners that refuse to sell. They've got nothing to sell. We're breaking even. We have a great youth setup, so we're actually making money by selling young players. But we're going nowhere, you know. We're literally, you know, we're going somewhere by coming to Brighton in the fifth round of the FA Cup.
Fact that you got 28,000 in the stadium though last week, does that actually give you hope that the support is still there? And if I mean, we know what it's like. When we're in the bobbing around the bottom leagues, the attendances dropped right off, and it was the hardcore only that would actually go. So, but I mean that, you know, would they come back?
I mean, there is a sort of a split. I mean, we've got 4,500 season ticket holders. We've got a core of people who have actually refused to go to home games.
They won't give Sisu any money, yeah?
Yeah, and, you know, I totally understand that in a way. The problem is we're kind of in limbo because, you know, you can't separate the club from their owners, and any damage you do or try and do to the owners, you damage the club. The fact that we didn't get hold of the ground or didn't let Sisu get hold of the ground means that the club doesn't get the ground. And, you know, how can you force people to sell something that they don't want to sell?
This is the weird thing, because, I mean, Brighton and Hove Albion doesn't own the land that it's on, but has got a 125-year lease on the ground itself. I mean, obviously, it owns the stadium, owns the infrastructure, you know, the buildings itself. But you're saying that you're actually doing this almost hand to mouth, year on year, that there's no guarantee of Coventry's ongoing future at the RICO on account of the fact that you still don't have a lease.
We're there. We've got a lease till the end of next season. Basically, that's just been agreed. I mean, we get a minimal amount.
Why has it only been
done
one at a time?
That's what's been agreed. I mean, you know, it's this sort of game of, it's this almost this game of chicken. I mean, Wasps have come in from London and bought the RICO complex. They're owned by a similar kind of company to Sisu. They have a whole mountain of debt in FAN and sort of these kind of bond schemes with a really high amount of interest. And it's almost like they could go under because they can't sustain a rugby team on rugby team money. Yeah. So, you know, it's almost like, are Coventry City owners trying to starve them out? Of course, we cannot leave Coventry again. It would be the death of the club. Going to Northampton nearly killed us anyway. There's just so much kind of... I wouldn't say there's so much anger and rancor. It's just that there's so many people, just lifelong fans, have turned their back on the club, may never come back, but there's still this load of excitement. You know, we went to... We increased the population of Nailsford, where Forest Green play, by 17% when we went there. We outnumbered Accrington Stanley fans when we went to their place. We outnumbered Milton Keynes fans when we played in the FA Cup in the last
round. That's not difficult, to be honest.
You know, I mean, you know, 8,000
fans.
4,500 fans
today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're up for the occasion. You know, we're up for a big occasion. I think whether we could sustain something, I think if Sisu ever got persuaded to sell, you'd see a few thousand on the gate, even where we are now.
Is there a knight in shining armour waiting in the wings to come in? And
well, the only potential buyer who sort of put his head, apart from a whole bunch of clowns who pop up sort of trying to do things, there's a guy called Gary Hoffman, who lifelong fan of the club. His family been involved with the club for years. Other people outside of football might know him as Northern Rock and Barclay Carter, head honcho. For me, there's a little bit of a question mark, because he was on the board when Sisu was sort of not doing the right thing and Ray Ransom was in charge and all this kind of stuff. But Sisu refused to talk to him and take any of his kind of offers and stuff. So it's hard to see. You know, a lot of clubs in the Midlands have been bought out by various Chinese-based companies, but they've all got assets in these massive football stadiums, and we don't have that. And that's always going to be a problem. Okay. And I can't see a way out of that. Ultimately, Sisu have to sell. It should be to a fans group or something, somebody that would do it as a labour of love, because I can't see any other way out unless we build a new stadium. And yeah,
You've only just done that.
Is there any danger of you finishing in the top six of the league anytime soon?
Ever.
After the FA Cup draw, everything was going great, and then we've just lost three games on the trot to Forest Green Rovers, Accrington Stanley and Colchester United.
You're good luck in the sixth round then, mate.
Well, you know, this is a day off for us today, so, you know.
It's a free hit.
On that note, we're going to have to leave it there, because we are out of time.
Just quickly, good luck with, you know, commentary going forward, after today, but good luck going forward.
So, of course, thank you to Alan West. Thank you to Rob Stevens. Cheers. Thank you to Gary Howlett. I've been AD Pack, and we'll see you again next week. And this has been the Albion Raw, sponsored by All Football Shirts, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks, bye.
Out of bed at 8 a.m. Out my head by 10:30. Out with mates and dates and friends. That's what I do at weekends. I can't talk and I can't walk, but I know where I'm going to go. I'm going to watch my money go at the Locarno. No, when my feet go through the door, I know what my right arm is for. Buy a drink and pull a chair up to the edge of the dance floor. Bouncers bouncing. their pies are really nice. I'll eat it in the taxi queue, standing someone else's spew. Wish I had lipstick on my shirt instead of piss stains on my shoe.